Gettysburg Seminary presents the Seminary Explores podcast. Conversations on faith, art, people, politics, theology, life, and more. With voices from around the corner and around the globe.
Well, hello, everyone. This is Kristen Largent here with the Seminary Explorers podcast, and I'm very happy to welcome our guest for today, Kent Graham, Dr. Kent Graham, who is visiting professor in the English department at Gettysburg College. He's been there about 5 years. Came from Wheaton College, and is just a real friend of Gettysburg Seminary because, Kent, you've been coming here for so long, so it's great to have you. Well, let me just to explain how I kind of came upon this to have you here, Kent. I was telling you earlier, we get a list of new publications from the Gettysburg College, from the faculty down there, and so I was sort of flipping through that. Michael had shared it with me, and I came across your new book, Psalms for Skeptics. And I thought, oh, that sounds very interesting. Let's bring him up here and talk about that, especially because your background, I think, is really very fascinating and interesting. So Kent has his BA in English and Philosophy from Carroll College, an MDiv from Princeton, including a semester of study at the University of Tübingen, and then an MA and PhD in English at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. But you chose the creative option, you had said, for your final project, and so you wrote a novel. And so you do 19th century American literature and creative writing. And I just finished doing an interview with Katie Giebenhain, who is here, who is our resident poet, and we were talking about kind of the interface between religion and poetry and you know, literature and creative writing and all of those things. And so this is really a natural kind of follow-up to that. And so I'm really eager to hear, I guess maybe let's just start with how you, I mean, you did your MDiv, but then moved on to English. I mean, but I assume that was maybe always in the back of your mind, or how have you seen these two fields, religion and English, sort of interfacing for you?
Well, for me, they were one thing, in a sense.
Okay.
And you have to kind of split that professionally, even though it might not be split in your mind.
Sure.
Or in your experience, you know, your life, whatever. But you have to at some point make a decision. So I was interested in both things. I knew that I loved teaching because I had done a little of it in my own schooling here and there. But I had always been interested in the ministry as well. So basically I did both in terms of my background and my training. And then at a certain point it came time to decide.
Right.
So, but deciding one way doesn't necessarily rule out the other, as many of your listeners would know.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Well, talk a little bit about your theology. I mean, how do you, what kind of theological convictions or religious claims inform your understanding of yourself as a Christian and your work kind of in the writing of this book, maybe in particular, and then there's a new one that just came out, The Prayer of Jesus, a reading of the Lord's Prayer. Where do you come to that theologically? From where do you come to that theologically, I guess I'm
saying? I think it's wonderful that you can ask that question in a way that doesn't make me feel like there's a spotlight.
Oh, good, I hope not.
big tough guys with pistols strapped to their hips, you know, standing on either side of me. That's sometimes the impression you get when you're asked that kind of question.
Oh.
Some places I've been and some places I've worked. But to answer it in a rather relaxed fashion, I was born and raised a Lutheran.
Okay.
ELCA Lutheran, baptized, confirmed, and so on. And that pretty much describes where I am. When I was in seminary, even though it was not a Lutheran seminary, most of my work in theology was Luther. I read a lot of Luther. I'm, I guess, what you would call a Trinitarian Christian.
Yeah.
As the title of the book suggests, I think that also involves looking at some of the questions honestly.
Yeah.
And if we don't know the answers to some of them, or if the answers that we do know point us away from traditional or orthodox theology, well, I think being honest is one of our obligations, not only as a human being, but as a Christian. So these Psalms for Skeptics are poems written without an agenda, that is, without trying to, without having a design on the reader.
Yeah.
You know, what Keats talked about, the irritable reaching after fact and reason and having a palpable design upon the reader. They're trying to find things out. And under the pressure of some of the difficulties of life, trying to examine some of these beliefs and going wherever you go.
Yeah.
Wherever that might happen to be.
Yeah. That's lovely. And that I think a lot of that is very Lutheran. I mean, you know, in the sense of the kind of trust in the work of the Holy Spirit and not being afraid to doubt, not being afraid to question, and trusting that God is the one that's at the center, not us. And like you said, to be able to follow that and really wrestle.
I think that doubt and questioning are in fact a part of faith, because they presuppose a belief in a person, God, who is not going to get angry and punitive because we're
right.
asking the wrong questions.
Right.
Or being too persistent about something.
Yep. Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, talk a little bit about the genesis of the book.
Well, I've been writing poetry virtually all my life, although that hasn't been mostly what I've published. I've published work in history and Civil War stuff, Lincoln stuff, mm-hmm. a novel. I won the Hart Crane Prize in Poetry way back in 1988.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah.
After that, sort of stopped sending things out. I kept writing, but mostly was consumed with writing prose.
Uh-huh.
But I had been, from that time and you know, almost 30 years since, writing formal poetry. That is, all these Psalms for Skeptics are sonnets.
Oh, okay.
Verse, they're all sonnets, and I teach
prayer
writing.
I love that form.
Sometimes students ask me, why would you commit yourself to
right. Yeah.
What, are you kidding? 140 syllables in a certain rhythm and rhymed in certain patterns? I mean, there are...
Well, say a little bit about that. Why don't we just remind everybody what a sonnet is?
Well, a sonnet is 14 lines of rhymed iambic pentameter. And the rhyme scheme can vary. You know, there's the English sonnet, and there's the Italian sonnet, or you know, the Shakespearean or Petrarchan. And it's a very strict, fixed form.
Yeah.
And most of what people read and write nowadays is free verse.
Right.
Well, there are some excellent writers of free verse, but I think what I would have to say is, in a sense, I'm not good enough to write free verse. I need help. I need the help of form. And what seems to be a difficulty to people, this arbitrary form that you lock yourself into, really is your partner.
Yeah.
It makes you do things, discover things, say things, realize things that you didn't know were coming, and you're not quite sure where they actually came from. And so it's a great help. Whereas if I were to approach something just from the standpoint of free verse, I would feel like I need to have something to say right from the beginning. But I think writing poems is more of a process of listening and discovering than it is saying something that you had in advance.
You know, I had never thought of this before, but when you were... I like poetry, but I'm pretty kind of specific in the kind of poetry that I like, and most of poetry that I like is not free form. And I realized when you said you need the help to write, I think I need the help of a form to read. I mean, for me, it also helps me read a poem when there's a kind of a structure to it.
Well, it does. It helps you understand tone.
Yeah, it does. That's very interesting.
Because any variation, any work with that rhythm, with the sounds, our tone, and tone on a page are the gestures, the inflections of voice, and all those things that you don't really have, but you do have in a conversation.
Yeah.
And also, there's nothing more natural.
Yeah.
We are almost, well, before birth, we are conditioned to hear that rhythm.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
And you naturally go for the sounds that rhyme makes. And I think where a lot of vigor is and where a lot of life is in today's poetry is in very distinctly rhythmic and rhyme stuff. I'm talking about rap, for example.
Oh, yeah, right. Oh, interesting.
So, I mean, a sonnet sounds like it's the farthest thing in the world from rap.
Yeah, right.
Not really. You know, it's still that. We love the music of poetry.
Yeah, we do. That's true. Well, but you called these sonnets psalms, not poems, for skeptics. And so tell me about that. What's a psalm to you?
Well, I should have explained that right at the outset. I took the Book of Psalms in the King James translation. And these are Psalms 101 through 150.
Okay.
And I took sometimes one, sometimes more than one phrase from a psalm and wrote a poem.
Oh, all right.
So there's that word or phrase that sort of sparks a question or some kind of response that I want to engage by writing a poem.
Okay.
So the poems, the psalms are the actual Book of Psalms, but a psalm is a song. And that's what the word sonnet means as well. It's a little song.
Mm.
So it's kind of an interplay between the original psalms and then my own little songs of discovery and response to elements in the originals.
Well, why don't we, let's hear one, and then we can have a better sense of what you mean.
Okay. Some of these I wrote in relation to the time of year it was.
Oh, okay.
For example, this one that I'm going to read, I hope it's not in all respects the politest of language in here, but that's one of the other things I try to do is to use the long-standing traditional form in a very modern idiom, that is to write contemporary language, even though it's in that almost ancient form. So what I was saying about the time of year, this happened to be Holy Saturday.
Okay.
And I was thinking about the traditional idea of the harrowing of hell, the idea
Jesus
descended into hell, as the creed says. What's more American than baseball? So this is Psalm 144, and the verse happened to be, "Blessed be the Lord, my strength, which teacheth my hands to war and my fingers to fight." So Jesus took Ruth's bat along to hell and belted Satan's balls out of the park. He waved a fan of tickets in an arc for Sunday's game. The field of asphodel was finished now, and all were welcome there. Standing at the plate, he looked like God, handsome as horses on Kentucky sod, beautiful as silver in winter air. I want your autograph on a clean slate. You are the resurrection and the life. Tomorrow will be the game of our dreams. Two out, bases loaded, last the ninth, a brute on the mound for the other team, the fans on their feet, the first and the late, three runs behind, and Jesus at the plate.
Oh, that's fabulous. My favorite line is, all on their feet, the first and the late.
Yeah.
Love that. Wonderful. Well, so tell me when you were... Well, I want to ask, first of all, why the King James translation?
I've been reading the Psalms in the King James translation since I was in my 20s.
Yeah.
I love the language. As a person who's a literature person, you know, literature teacher, I realize that the translation is not always accurate or up to date, and the language has changed. So if you're reading it for study... you'd read it with a newer version alongside.
Mm-hmm.
But there, I think nothing that I have seen equals the quality of inspiration, the ability to inspire me, us, that compares to the language of King James.
Yeah.
So it was a natural to use that.
Yeah.
These phrases simply are sound pretty flat some contemporary translations.
Yeah. Well, and I think there's certainly something that when it has been with you, the language has been with you so long, you know, it's hard to, it also just carries so much memory and the beauty of the language certainly is newer translations don't compare to that in a way, I think. And then how did you choose the verse from each psalm? Was it one that was particularly meaningful, or you like your favorite, or
it was more of an intuitive process?
Okay.
I mean, at a certain point, as I suggested before, you start to listen. And so if I was sitting down, or sometimes I write standing up to write a poem, and you need a kind of a discipline, it helps to have a certain time of day and a certain place to do it.
Okay.
Because it's a way of getting your unconscious enlisted, you know,
without
having to go through all the rigmarole and ceremony anew every time. So same time, same place. And I look at the psalm, you know, I went through them one at a time. So what's today's psalm? So I would read it, and simply intuitively, or however, I don't know, a phrase would stand out. I don't know why.
Yeah, right.
And that's the phrase I would take.
And why'd you choose the last 50 psalms? Or 40? What'd you say?
Well, I'm doing all 150. And I did 50, sort of perversely, I started.
Okay.
So I did 50 through 100, and I don't like them very much, so I'm redoing those. And I did 1 through 50.
Okay.
Just 50, 1 through 100.
Yeah.
Those are coming out, by the way, probably this summer.
Fabulous.
Called Psalms for the Poor. That'd be 1 through 50.
Okay.
And this one was the one I did last. And I think because I wanted to revise the first two sets, and I was more or less satisfied with this one, that's why I submitted this one first.
Okay.
So that went in first.
Okay.
There's another one or two coming.
And why skeptics in particular?
Well, because it just sort of happened that during the couple of years that I was writing this, I was thinking about some things in a fairly analytical and questioning way that was reflected in some of the psalms.
Okay.
I've always been concerned, even in the historical stuff that I write, with the question of theodicy. So how is it possible to believe in a God who's all-knowing and merciful and powerful and see what happens in the world around us and what happens to ourselves? So you ask those questions.
Yeah.
There's a series of poems about Job in this book, Psalms for Skeptics, and they're pretty skeptical. I mean,
yeah.
Job was a person who had a right to be very skeptical.
Yeah, absolutely. Read another one. And then I'm going to choose one. You can choose this one. I'm going to choose one.
Okay. that's fair enough.
Yeah.
So what could be more American than baseball? Well, maybe Marilyn Monroe, at least for this, my generation. So what if Marilyn Monroe had been one of those people in one of the houses along the street on Palm Sunday? The verse that I took is, "Thy word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path." Mm-hmm. Under the right light, I have shapely feet, and I know my way around. But show me the way to my name. Where is the old street carpeted with palms? Maybe they know me there. I watched from a window, half asleep. I heard the people murmuring early, but I was lazy, afraid to be seen out there, platinum, breathless, and girly, with nothing on but my new radio. I was a citizen of Rome, you know, and Hollywood was such a jealous Joe. So I prayed for my Savior to go, took a few pills, called JFK, and lay down naked and waited. Show me a way.
Wow.
I'm not an expert on Marilyn Monroe, but I know about Joe DiMaggio and some of the things she said. And I think that she is much more than what she ostensibly was, a sex symbol for American males. I think she symbolized something for all of us, and that was that kind of vulnerability and loss.
Mm-hmm.
And the tragedy of losing herself. I think she was great. She was a great actress because she played Marilyn Monroe, and we all believed it.
Yeah.
And then eventually she was stuck in that role.
Yeah. What were the three adjectives? Platinum, breathless, and
girly.
I'm thinking about, I think it's Chanel that's been using her, a recording of her voice, talking about that, I don't sleep, I sleep naked, I sleep in the nude only with Chanel number 5 or something. And they, and I thought, you know, we really have not let her, she doesn't get to be anything more than that, yeah. as we sort of look back. So that's, yeah, interesting. I didn't want to get up, I didn't want to see. Yeah. I want you to read me the one from Psalm 150. That happy, happy, joyous psalm. What did you do with that, Kent?
Well, I was wondering how you were going to ask me which, you know, to read which one. So that's at the end of this.
Well, I think when I, you know, I don't know the psalms nearly as well as some of my colleagues, especially Brooke Schramm, whom I'm sure you also know, who teaches a course on psalms regularly to great acclaim. The students love it. And Luther, of course, said, you know, the Psalter is the Bible in miniature because it really is everything there. So when I think about the latter half, that latter third of the psalms, I always think about those closing 5 or however many it is that are just about praise, you know, kind of unconditionally, and I love those because I tend to be one of these kind of happy people. So I just, so I want to hear what you...
Well, I didn't get there easily.
Okay.
These poems present a kind of a narrative or a process by which a lot of the difficulties, you know, had to be faced, mm-hmm. and I really wasn't sure how they were going to come out as I was writing them.
Do they need to be read sequentially?
Well,
do you sort of see them?
No, they don't need to be read that way. I wrote them so that each of them could be an individual unit, but if you do read them in order, then I think a kind of a narrative of skepticism and faith emerges, or skepticism and some kind of resolution.
Yeah, okay.
So, therefore, coming to the end, after a long, difficult process, this was something that I might well not have written at the very beginning.
Oh, okay.
Psalm 150, praise him with a psaltery and harp. The angels sing somewhere beyond our ears, alleluias tender and tremendous, above the firmament, above the years, where beginnings round on the never-ending. Above the waters where the stars come out of thought, and Grandpa dreams of glistening fish. Above the boiler room of physics, doubt, and angleworms, fresh crayons in a dish are ready to color a new Atlantis whenever we are ready for another descent. And notes of the lake of heaven glimmer like fish in the river of mothers. Master, after this short singing's end, give us back the harp, and we'll start again.
Oh, very nice.
Thank you.
Give us back the harp, and we'll start again. Wonderful. Well, it was a delight to have a conversation with you. And again, the book is Psalms for Skeptics. Kent Graham, G-R-A-M-M. I kept spelling your name wrong when I was emailing you back and forth. He has another book. Maybe we'll have another conversation down the road, The Prayer of Jesus, A Reading of the Lord's Prayer. And then you said another volume, Psalms for the Poor.
Psalms for the Poor.
It's going to come out this summer.
I think it'll be this summer.
Yeah, super.
It's in production now.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. It was a delight to talk with you.
Thank you very much.
You have been listening to The Seminary Explores from Historic Seminary Ridge in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, a production of Gettysburg Seminary. We invite you to visit our website at www.ltsg.edu. Opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of Gettysburg Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.